That lines Israel continues to target the Gaza Strip with deadly air raids, prompting fresh retaliatory strikes from Palestinian resistance fighters. Expert-level talks resume for a second day in Vienna as part of negotiations for the removal of sanctions against Iran. Plus, Chinese fighter jets and warships engage in major maritime drills around Taiwan following the U.S. House Speaker's controversial visit to the island. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. More Palestinians fall victim to Israeli strikes as the regime continues to hit the besieged Gaza Strip for a second consecutive day. The latest attacks have killed three people, bringing to 13 the number of those who have lost their lives since Friday. Israeli attacks have also wounded over 110 people over the past 2 days. Tel Aviv has vowed to press ahead with its aerial operations. Palestinian resistance groups have also continued their retaliatory attacks. The Islamic Jihad says it has fired dozens of rockets at Israeli towns and military sites. Palestinian resistance groups have ruled out any truce, stressing that the regime must fully pay for its actions. To get an update on the situation in Gaza, we're joined by our correspondent Ashraf Shannon, live from Gaza City. Ashraf, tell us if you have any updates.
Well, Gisu, the number of fatalities in Gaza over the last 36 hours has risen to 14. Four people were killed today and 10 yesterday, and scores of people were injured. While Palestinian resistance factions continue to fire retaliatory rockets towards the Israeli regime and also towards Israeli military posts around the Gaza Strip, Israel also continues to attack Gaza. They bombed at least two buildings today, completely destroying them and displacing dozens of more families. Yesterday, when they assassinated top Islamic Jihad commander Taysir Jabari, they hit an apartment building that houses over 100 families. All these people left the building fearing for their lives. Meanwhile, the Gaza Sol power generating plant stopped working at 12 noon today due to lack of fuel, because Israel has been closing the crossings into the Gaza Strip since Tuesday and not allow fuel to enter the Gaza Strip. While the Gaza's main hospital, the Shifa Medical Complex, announced that it could stop its services within 72 hours because of lack of fuel and lack of electricity, and also a lack of medical supplies for the hospitals. The situation is still extremely tense in Gaza as Palestinian resistance factions continue to fire rockets towards the Israeli regime, and the Israeli forces also pounding mainly civilian targets in the Gaza Strip, as they have done over the last years. Israel has waged four wars on Gaza since 2007, and this is the fifth main onslaught against Gaza, and claiming the lives of thousands of innocent civilians, including hundreds of women and children, while the world watches in silence. The whole situation started last week on Monday upon the arrest and torture of Bassam Saadi, the top Islamic Jihad official in the occupied West Bank town of Jenin, and Islamic Jihad just issued threats against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of al-Saadi. Instead, Israel worsened his detention condition and placed Gaza, increased the blockade of Gaza by sealing the two crossings into the territory since Tuesday. And then yesterday assassinated the top Islamic Jihad military commander and increased the attacks against the Gaza Strip.
Thank you very much. That was Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent, joining us live from Gaza with the latest on the situation there. Now, Mick Knapp here from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign says Israeli politicians often compete in killing the highest number of Palestinians in order to succeed in elections.
The in the past, the political competition in the Zionist bloc has often led to attacks on Gaza, has often led to bloodletting. Indeed, during two elections back, Benny Gantz, the moderate, competed with Netanyahu by producing an electoral video asking for Israelis to vote for him, and he included pictures, videos of Israel, of Palestinian funerals, coffins, and in it he said he had bombed Gaza back to the Stone Age, and you should vote for him because he would kill more Palestinians. He actually had, during the 2 or 3 minute video, a little counter in the corner of his video saying how many Palestinians he had been responsible for killing during a particular attack on Gaza. It's been a constant of Israeli politics and behavior that they use extreme naked violence against the Palestinian people, quite simply because there's really nothing to negotiate. Either the Palestinians submit, in which case they will continue to be dispossessed every day, every week. There will be more land taken from Palestinians for exclusively Jewish occupation. So if they don't resist, they'll be dispossessed. And if they resist, the Israelis only know the language of violence and they must be crushed. And that's what we're seeing at the moment.
Condemnations are pouring in following Israel's fatal airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi said the attacks once again showed the Israeli regime as seeking aggression and occupation. He said Palestinian resistance will expedite Tel Aviv's downfall. Also, the IRGC's chief commander said the quick response by the Palestinian resistance movement proves that they are increasing power. Hossein Salami says the Zionist regime will pay another heavy price for its recent crimes. Turkey has also strongly condemned the air raids. Ankara says it is unacceptable to kill civilians. Yemen's National Salvation Government and Ansarullah movement condemned the Israeli airstrikes as well. Ansarullah also reaffirmed Palestinians' right to respond to the aggression. Qatar, Jordan, Algeria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, as well as Iraq's Qatib Hezbollah group and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, have all condemned the Israeli aggression. And talks between Iran and the P4+1 on the 2015 deal have resumed in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Negotiations are being held at the expert level. The two sides are trying to narrow their differences on major issues. Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani arrived in the Austrian capital on Thursday. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA, was derailed after Washington withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April last year in an attempt to revive the deal. Mohammad Marandi is an advisor to Iran's negotiating team in Vienna. He believes it is still too soon to be either optimistic or pessimistic about the outcome of the JCPOA revival talks.
I think we should not be pessimistic, nor should we be optimistic. There has been progress. If you read between the lines from what European officials are saying, it's quite clear that they have adjusted their position on multiple issues. So that means there is progress. However, we still haven't reached the end of the negotiations. We are not quite sure. We're not sure at all whether the Europeans and the Americans, especially the Americans, will accept Iran's conditions. As I said, there is some movement on the Western side, which is a plus. But as they have been saying for a very long period of time, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So we're still going to have to wait a bit to see what happens.
Taiwan accuses the Chinese army of stimulating an attack on the island as Beijing continues major maritime drills around Taiwan. This following a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taipei. On Saturday, Chinese fighter jets flew near Taiwan and warships sailed in the Taiwan Strait as part of the drill. Taiwan says some of those planes and ships crossed the demarcation line that divides the strait, which Beijing does not recognize. Taiwan says it mobilized air and land patrols and deployed land-based missile system in response. China's drills are seen as part of the country's military and political response to Pelosi's trip to the self-ruled island, which China claims as its own territory. Beijing says the trip interfered with the Chinese internal affairs and undermined the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
A series of drills across six zones surrounding Chinese Taipei. Conventional missile firepower assault in the waters east of Taiwan. More than 100 warplanes, including fighters and bombers, as well as over 10 destroyers and frigates. These are the largest military drills that China has conducted perhaps ever, showing its awesome military might. This level of force displayed in such a manner shows how angry China is at the U.S. and the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit.
Interparliamentary.
Since 1949, that Taiwan is an integral part of China. And they see that as China has moved from being under the control of imperialist powers to becoming a strong, independent nation, that they intend to exercise sovereignty over all of their historical geographical range, including Taiwan.
Ironically, the G7 group of countries and the High Representative of the European Union have now issued a statement condemning these exercises, claiming that they threaten the stability of the region. In this instance, the European side has now backed the U.S. when it comes to its stance against China. Is this another Ukraine conflict scenario playing out? China sees this as a provocation, since it is endorsing and encouraging pro-separatist and pro-independence forces on the island.
Chinese made their strikes, probably using our visit as an excuse. Let me close by saying this. The Chinese have tried to isolate Taiwan. They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there.
There is no question that after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit, the relationship between U.S. and China has nosedived. China said it was ending cooperation with the United States on a whole host of issues, including climate change, anti-drug efforts, and military issues. There may be other actions that China will take that are not very clear at this point.
China has in the past viewed Chinese Taipei as part of its territory. It has also publicly stated that it may take it by force one day if necessary. This is where the U.S. and now Europe come in. Just like Ukraine, both are warning China against any thoughts of a takeover, which parallels the conflict in Ukraine.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
I think the issue of provoking China is this. The United States does not have, as part of its sort of thinking, that somebody is going to be our equal. We have in the Western Pacific this amazing amount of military. Well, China happens to be there. You know, that's part of the world that they're in. And I think that as time goes on, and they have been very clear about this, that they're not prepared to cede American military hegemony to us in the Western Pacific much longer.
But China is not Ukraine, if the military display of China is anything to go by. The U.S. provocations against China and Europe's support come at a dangerous time when the world economy is on the precipice. The U.S. anti-China stance and China's maneuvers are taking place along some of the world's busiest shipping routes. Let's not forget, the global supply of vital semiconductors and electronic equipment produced in East Asia are in this region. Additionally, more than 60% of global maritime trade and more than 22% of the total global trade passes through the South China Sea. Is the U.S. and its European allies willing to risk this?
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary.
The last thing I would like to recommend is for you to follow up on the files you open and to finish them. Finish the various cases involving public affairs that the judiciary has started. For example, about some factories, some illegal seizures, and the like. You shouldn't open a wound and then not finish it up. Of course, there is usually a big commotion in the beginning when something like this is being done. Then it is slowly forgotten. Whatever you start, whatever issue it is, he mentioned central issues are very good. Especially pursue these because of their priority. Finish the matter and complete the cases. Then you can move aside. Your work is hard, truly hard. Indeed, the work of the judiciary is one of the jobs that is very difficult. I have been in the ongoing executive affairs of the revolution since the beginning of the revolution. I have always said that I am afraid of accepting to be in charge of matters related to the judiciary branch, and I have avoided doing so because this is a very difficult job and it is very demanding.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You have taken on much work on yourselves. Well, the reward for this is just as much. That is, in proportion to the amount of the work that is done, the divine reward that is given is also just as much, insha'Allah. Follow up on the work that is being done for the sake of God. follow up on work while benefiting from divine guidance. God willing, inshallah, you will be given the divine reward. You may do a good action at times and no one realizes it, not even your manager or your boss. Your subordinates may not understand what you have done either. For example, you may have worked a few hours overtime, or maybe you did a job carefully, or perhaps you fought diligently with corruption and dishonesty. No one may realize what you have done, but the scribes of God realize. Furthermore, the Almighty God is present and watching over all of this himself. God willing, your reward is with Allah. I hope that God the Almighty will make the pure soul of the great Imam Khomeini happy and unite the pure souls of the martyrs with the friends of God. May God unite the soul of dear Shaheed Beheshti with the friends of God, God willing, inshallah, and may he bless us all with a good end to our lives. May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Africa Today.
The government of Eritrea has compelled the Israeli regime to close its embassy in the country after it rejected an ambassador appointed by the Tel Aviv regime. Now, the decision marks yet another moment of continued isolation of the Israeli regime in Africa. It's not surprising that Eritrea took that decision because the Israeli regime, which is trying to infiltrate Africa, has deeply rooted racist and apartheid policies. In fact, Jacques Yosef, a senior Israeli rabbi, believes that the people of Africa are monkeys. Let's take a listen. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and it's always great welcoming you here at Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative analysis of news making headlines in Africa. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the decision by the Israeli regime to close its embassy in Eritrea, a strategic Horn of Africa nation. We're asking, is the move a pointer to further isolation of the Tel Aviv regime in Africa? The second part of our program today will be on the drought currently ravaging parts of Sudan, where aid agencies say that nearly one quarter of the entire population will struggle to access food in the coming months. We're asking, what needs to be done to utilize Sudan's massive potential in agriculture? Our experts will be giving us their incisive analysis on these two subjects today.
Eritrea rejects Israeli regime. Israeli regime's Prime Minister Yair Lapid has been forced to close the regime's embassy in Eritrea as authorities in this strategic northeast African country have rejected the ambassador appointed 2 years ago by Tel Aviv. On July 5, 2020, the regime's Foreign Ministry's Appointments Committee appointed Ismail Khaldi to serve as ambassador to Eritrea. The approval of his appointment was, however, rejected by Eritrean authorities. According to Israeli media outlets, the embassy had remained empty in the aftermath of the Eritrean government's decision.
While the Eritrean government has not issued a statement on the closure of the Israeli embassy in Asmara, The decision comes as many international organizations have clearly stated that Israel is an apartheid regime. So, just as the South African white minority apartheid regime was isolated internationally, there are indicators that many African countries, including Eritrea, believe that Tel Aviv is a racist regime. Clearly, early this year, Amnesty International stated that Israel is an apartheid regime.
Amnesty International is here today to call on the authorities of Israel to put an end to the system of apartheid it is maintaining against all Palestinians living under their effective control, whether in Israel itself, in the OPT, or as refugees in other countries. We are here today to call on the international community to take resolute action against the crime of humanity being perpetrated in order to maintain the system of apartheid.
Now, for more on the decision to close the Israeli regime's embassy in Asmara, we contacted Inem Richardson, the co-founder of Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot for joining us today, madam.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, what prompted the government of Eritrea to reject the ambassador appointed by the Israeli regime?
Well, one thing to understand about Eritrea is that Eritrea is a country that is extremely adamant and proud about guarding its own national sovereignty post its independence. And so Eritrea is the only country in Africa that does not have a military relationship with the United States through AFRICOM, a huge assertion of sovereignty on a continent that's otherwise pretty dominated by imperialist intervention. Eritrea also has a long history of solidarity with the Palestinian people, dating at least as far back to its independence struggle. So Eritrea and the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the general Palestinian freedom struggle were really close allies throughout the latter half of the 20th century. Israel, on the other hand, took the side of Ethiopia, which was under a very repressive regime during the time that was repressive not only to the Eritreans who were fighting for their independence, but also for many of the peoples within Ethiopia. So Israel has this history of intervening in the Horn of Africa against the interest of the Eritrean people, as well as the interest of the Ethiopian people as well.
Eritrea is strategically located in the Horn of Africa on the Red Sea and the Bab-el-Mandeb Strait, making it a geopolitically strategic and important state along the world's busiest shipping lane. Eritrea's Foreign Minister Osman Saleh Mohammed believes that the unipolar world order is coming to an end and that the conflicts in Africa are instigated by external powers.
In as far as global trends is concerned, I had stated, and I quote, the world is on the cusp of a new world order. All vital parameters indicate that the unipolar world order has come to an end or is in its twilight year. The economic power balance is inexorably changing with a spike in attendant intense rivalries and upheavals.
What are the implications for the Israeli regime following Eritrea's rejection of its envoy, particularly considering the strategic importance of this country?
As you mentioned, Eritrea is located on the Red Sea. It straddles, you know, it's right between these two parts of the world. It's not so far from Yemen and the countries of the Gulf, but it's also part of the African continent. So the Horn of Africa is very much like a gateway into the rest of Africa from Israel's point of view, based off of where Israel is located. So by not having access to Eritrea in this way, it prevents Israel in some way that blocks Israel off from the rest of the continent. And Israel has had a long history of intervention, not just in the Horn, but other parts of Africa, solidarity with the apartheid regime of South Africa historically, intervention in Uganda as well in the 70s. But through not having access to Eritrea, which would be one of the closest points of access into the African continent for Israel, it's a step back in terms of being able to penetrate directly and access these other parts of the continent as well.
Last year, at least 14 countries, including Eritrea, vehemently opposed Israeli regime's observer status at the African Union and agreed to expel it from the 55-member bloc. Now, a leading Pan-Africanist, PLO Lumumba, says he sees no merit in the Israeli regime being an observer member of the African Union.
I find no merit in Israel enjoying observer status at the African Union. And thirdly, I am puzzled why that is important at all. I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU, unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Activists in African countries have been working to intensify their struggle against Israeli regime's apartheid practices against Palestinians. These activists say Israel must be isolated the same way that apartheid South Africa was sanctioned. In February, the African Union suspended the debate on whether to withdraw Israel's accreditation as an observer to the bloc. The move by Eritrea reject Israeli regime's ambassador is seen as a pointer of further isolation of the regime in Africa.
We certainly hope so, and I do believe that Israel's relationship with Africa as a whole is really on shaky grounds. It's not something that's very stable or sustainable because it's very unpopular with the majority of the people who are living within Africa. Because Israel has such a close relationship to a lot of the countries that have historically intervened, and even in recent times intervened for regime change in Africa, because of Israel's relationship to the United States, France, the UK, and other colonial and neocolonial powers, it means that sometimes African countries don't always act within the interests of their people, as well as their own national interests as a whole. But because of how generally unpopular Israel is in Africa among the people, it is really hard to, this sort of relationship would be really, really hard to defend and sustain. So Eritrea leading the fight against the normalization of this sort of relationship is really significant.
The Israeli regime is known to meddle in the internal affairs of African countries in a bid to push its nefarious agenda. Now, recently, the regime's notorious Mossad spy agency was implicated in a plot to overthrow the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, is Eritrea at risk of being destabilized by the Israeli regime?
Eritrea is going to do everything it can to maintain its sovereignty, which it's demonstrated time and time again that it prioritizes its own sovereignty in the face of a world that is, dominated by Western imperialism. And then in this sort of vein, Israel's allyship with the Western imperialists. So Eritrea is going to try everything to guard its own sovereignty, but it is threatened for regime change already by Israel and ally states. So we see U.S. sanctions on Eritrea as one example of this. So there's already an effort to try to destabilize Eritrea in this way. And this is something that is at risk. The risk is intensified by this decision to reject Israel. Because Eritrea is on such a divided continent, and there is a lack of concrete African unity on a political level, it really does make the risk heightened in a lot of ways.
Addressing the African Union summit held in Addis Ababa last February, Palestinian Prime Minister urged African countries to reject the Israeli regime due to the apartheid policies it imposes on Palestinians.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion.
Eritrea and other African countries have for long supported the liberation of Palestinian territories occupied by the Israeli regime. So why is the liberation of Palestine important for African countries?
The liberation of Palestine is super important for African people and for the liberation of the African continent. If you look at historically, we see that almost pretty much all of the revolutionary struggles, all of the struggles that were in line with the people in Africa, whether it's the Eritrean struggle for their independence, whether it's Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso, whether it's the struggle of the peoples of South Africa against apartheid and also against settler colonialism and these things, we see that the people are always on the side of Palestine because we recognize that the history is very, very similar. It's a history of colonialism. It's a history of imperialism, of exploitation, and of occupation. It's the same enemies. Israel was created through the United Kingdom or by the United Kingdom during this epoch of the British Empire, the same British Empire that dominated the majority of Africa during the late 19th, 20th century. So we have this shared history of struggle against oppression.
Well, there you have it. The shared history of the struggle against colonialism and imperialism is a factor in Africa's opposition to the Israeli regime and support for Palestinian independence struggle. I'd like to thank our guest, the co-founder of Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity, for her insight today. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the drought ravaging Sudan. So stay with us.
Drought ravaging Sudan.
Aid agencies say millions in Sudan will struggle to access food in the coming months, including 3.1 million people facing emergency levels of hunger. Displaced children and their families, refugees, and people directly impacted by conflict are likely to be most vulnerable to hunger.
The ongoing crisis has been exacerbated by a worsening economic situation, recurring violence throughout many states, a poor harvest, and the global price shocks in the fuel, grains, and other food commodities.
Sudanese farmers are struggling to find new crops as the government has failed to buy their harvest under promised terms. A Sudanese farmer says they are facing a difficult situation.
The summer season is threatened with collapse. 50%, 70% of us might not plant, and that puts the food supply in question. Farmers are in a difficult position. People are in a difficult position. The situation has become very difficult.
Now, to discuss the food security situation in Sudan, we contacted Adel Abdelati, the chairman of the Sudan of the Future Political Bloc. Now, aid agencies say Sudan is facing a severe shortage of food and medicines, leading to the spread of malnutrition and diseases. Now, is the situation getting worse in this country?
Yes, unfortunately, Sudan is facing a big shortage of food. Sudan is importing wheat from Ukraine and from Russia. And we know that now there is no supplies from these two countries. And about 18 million of people are facing the danger of hunger and shortage of food. This situation should be addressed and should be solved as soon as possible because otherwise we will have a humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
Thousands of protesters continue to organize massive protests in Sudan's capital and other parts of the country in demonstrations against the country's ruling military generals. A Sudanese protester says they will continue with street demonstrations to ensure that remnants of the former regime don't remain in power.
We believe this revolution needs to be monitored so as not to be hijacked by members of the former regime or even by political parties.
Apart from the Ukraine crisis, has the political instability in Sudan contributed to the food shortage in the country?
That is true. The instability in the country, of course, a situation where there is lack of security, there is lack of stability on the political level. There is no, in fact, government. We don't have a prime minister. We don't have a government which has some kind of popular support. and all the time we have demonstrations. And in fact, we have a failed government and a failed state. And this, of course, is worsening the situation. Also, bad economic decisions, because farmers in Sudan, they have collected a very good collection of wheat in this year, but the policies of the government and the policies of the agriculture bank by forcing non-commercial, non-rental prices for the Sudanese wheat has resulted in farmers refusing to sell their products.
A joint report from the World Food Programme and the Food and Agriculture Organization last June concluded that 15 million people in Sudan face acute food insecurity. These UN agencies say projections for later in the year indicate that this might be increasing to some 18 million people.
WFP Sudan has just completed its food security assessment. Unfortunately, our worst fears have been confirmed. We estimate at this point in time that some 15 million people are going hungry in Sudan. Our projections for later in the year indicate that this might be increasing to some 18 million people.
NATO's imperialism, military expansionism, which ignited the Ukraine conflict, has disrupted global food supply and worsened the food crisis for African countries. These US-led NATO countries have spent billions of dollars in military assistance to Ukraine while ignoring appeals by UN agencies for emergency funds to alleviate the suffering of tens of millions in need of urgent food aid. Sudan is one of the countries facing inadequate international response to the drought situation.
The response of the international community is not enough. Of course, there was alert from the international organization dealing with food security, dealing with health, but these alerts finished with only alerting, and there was no quick response from international community, international relief organizations. And before all, there was no good response from the government.
Sudan's Minister of Trade and Supply, Amal Saleh Saad, recently called for agricultural investments in the country and for the exploitation of the vast Sudanese agricultural lands, adding that the country could serve as a food basket for other countries in the region. Now, Sudan is a country blessed with abundant water resources and fertile soils, and was once referred to as Africa's emerging bread basket. So what really went wrong?
That is true that Sudan has a lot of water resources, a very fertilized land, and a very hardworking people, farmers. And this could be a good assist for Sudan to be one of the leaders in Africa, if not in the whole world, in providing food and food security for its citizens and for Africa. But the problem is a bad governance. The problem is political before all. Sudan has lacked security, has lacked stability for the last, 33 years. After the toppling of Bashir, we did not have stable government. We have for 2 years, a mixed government of civilian and military, but also it was a very weak government. Now we have a military government which is faced by a very strong opposition from young people, from political parties, and in this situation you can't manage the country in a good way.
Now, so what measures can be taken to restore Sudan's glory as an agricultural country capable of meeting its needs and exporting food to other African countries?
The first step is to settle the political crisis and to build a stable government, with some kind of popular support and political support, because the military alone could not rule the country, and they have big challenges to maintain stability and security. The second measure is to allocate to allocate money for investing in agriculture sector, and before all, to provide very quick support to farmers, in order to supply the market with food products and with agriculture products. Also, there should be a good supporting policies for agriculture in the country, and concentrating on transforming the agriculture from traditional agriculture to industrial agriculture.
Well, democratically elected government and massive investment in agriculture are critical if Sudan is to use its potential as Africa's breadbasket. That's the opinion of our guest today, Adil Abdel Ati, the chairman of the Sudan of the Future Political Bloc. I'd like to thank him for his incisive analysis today. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It was great having you watch the show today. Please let us know what you think by dropping us a line through our social media. And goodbye for now.
Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "Perform pilgrimage to Karbala, and don't stop doing this, for Karbala has embraced the best son of the prophets."
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. We've been in the studio. We have very special guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Murtaza Karimi, an Islamic expert from the Islamic Hausa of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to your show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
So, we have been discussing in our previous discussions some strange cases and instances which took place after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which might not be understood easily by the rational sciences, or it's better to say the normal mentality of the people, because they look very much metaphorical, symbolic, and miraculous. For example, one of them was shedding tears by the earth and the sky, and the glorification of the earth and the skies and the heavens, we can say, related to the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. If agree, I enumerate some other cases, and then you bring up the authentic references of them taking place.
Sure.
For instance, about one of the strange cases which took place, according to some of the documents, and it is documented in the especially the general history of Shia Islam, is shedding blood under the stones on the desert of Karbala. Is it true or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous program, the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is unique. Nothing like that has happened before 61 after Hijrah, and will not happen till the Day of Judgment. So we should not reject such phenomena because of the fact that, I mean, they might seem weird and strange. But again, it doesn't mean that we need to accept everything. We need to refer to the historical books and the collections of hadith to see the narrations which talk about that.
Yes.
So the narrations about the heavens and the earth crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam are many. And as you rightly mentioned, according to some narrations, on the day of Ashura, at least in some places, when they remove some stones, there was fresh blood under that stone. First of all, Nowadays, we hear from time to time that the same is going to is happening in some regions in the world. So whether these stories or these stories are true or not, for each case, we need to go and check.
Yes.
Because I don't want. My point is that when we hear such a thing in the narrations, which is the case, it doesn't mean that if every person comes to us and tells us a story that in this certain
area
or origin we have seen the same on the day of Ashura, we just accept that. No, I mean the scholars should go that go there. And when we receive enough news from a trustworthy person, then we may agree.
Yes.
So this is another story. What's happening in our time and era? And there are some stories in different parts of the world.
Or, for example, the stones or the marbles out of the gravestone of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam becomes bloody and red in color. Yeah. This has been also seen and filmed and documented.
Yeah, it's been documented, but I'm not able to, because myself I've not witnessed it. What we are talking
to
in
prove
today's
it.
Session is just only about what happened on the day of Ashura, based on the narrations.
Okay.
So again, according to some narrations, it has happened at least in the land of Karbala, and in some cases, we have witnesses and reports from some people who have seen that, and they have narrated the story that on that day they, for example, removed one stone and they found fresh blood.
Yes.
So it shows that at least it has happened for some people, for some cases. Did it happen for every stone on the earth? Not necessarily.
No. Okay.
So what we understand from these narrations is that it has happened for some people. They have seen and witnessed that. And there is a very famous narration in both Shia and Sunni sources about the hadith is famous as the hadith of Qarura, a glass. The fact that the Holy Prophet brought some oil, some soil from the land of Karbala to Umm Salama, and she had it in a glass, and she narrates that on a specific day, and the Holy Prophet tells her that the day that you see that the soil turns into blood or it becomes red, then make sure that Hussein alayhi salam has been killed.
Yes.
And Umm Salama narrates the story, and she says that one day I saw the same thing happened, and I made sure that this is the day that Holy Prophet predicted. So we have these stories mentioned in, it's not only, limited to Shia sources. It's been mentioned in Sunni sources as well.
Yes.
Now, in this case, we are talking about a physical phenomenon. So it's not like crying of the heavens, which we said that we may explain that in a metaphorical way.
Yes.
No, this is a physical phenomenon happening.
Yes.
And there are narrations talking about that in both Shia and Sunni narrations, and that is why we need to accept that.
They are very much, I think, time-bound because, the specific Ashura, the 10th day of the Muharram in the year 61
That's
AH was a very special day.
Exactly.
These cases might not be repeated, during the other Ashuras during
At
the
least
history.
We need to check. Yes. As I mentioned, the point
but
is
But for
that
sure, on that day, some strange things happened on the earth.
Exactly.
Okay, that's all right. Okay.
So for this case, again, we need to say that based on the narrations, we may accept that at least for some cases, for few people, they have seen and they have reported the story.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
That's all right. We know it was a really harsh tragedy, and even so many people, so many members of even the forces of the enemy, we can say, shed tears on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Their hearts were moved by what happened to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Some of them even, on the day of Ashura, did repentance and joined the army of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and were martyred on his way. Okay, all of them are related to the human beings. What about the other, we can say, entities? Like, for example, the jinns, because especially about the jinns and the jinns forces, we have ayahs in the Holy Quran referring to them and their creatures, and I mean their creation and their, as I said, entity is absolutely accepted by all the people, especially the Muslims, based on the Quranic text. What about them? For example, any mourning, shedding tears for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam?
Let me, share one point, and that is the fact that when it comes to such details about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, for all these details that you mentioned, we have some narrations.
Yes.
But the number of the narrations differ from one phenomenon to another, and the authenticity of the chain may differ from one to another.
Yes.
So for some of them, we have so many narrations, and that is why we cannot reject that. So we have it for the heavens and the earth crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And we have it for, finding blood under the stones. Let me at least give the dear listener some sources for the fact that there was blood, fresh blood under some stones. For example, we have it in Common Ziyarat, page 77, Bihar al-Anwar, volume 45, page 202, Manaqib ibn Shahrashub, volume 1, page 269. And amongst Sunni sources, we may mention Mu'jam al-Kabir by Tabarani, volume 3, page 113 and 119, Majmu' al-Zawa'id, volume 9, page 315, and so on and so forth. For example, one narration reads, لما قتل الحسين عليه السلام, when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was killed, so as you rightly mentioned, it's talking about 61 after Hijra, the 10th day. لم يبقى في بيت المقدس or في بيت المقدس حصات إلا وجد تحتها دم عبيد. There was no stone in بيت المقدس, Jerusalem, except that there was fresh blood on, under it. Or in another narration, لم يرفع عن وجه الأرض حجر إلا وجد تحته دم عبيد. This is mentioned by Sheikh al-Saduq in Al-Amali, page 167. And for the hadith of Qarura and Umm Salama, the listeners may find it in Al-Ishad by Sheikh al-Mufid, volume 2, page 130. And as for Sunni sources, they may refer to Khasa'is al-Kubra, volume 2, page 193, and many other sources.
Yes.
So again, it seems that this is also well authenticated.
Okay. That's all right.
When it comes to jinns crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, in Kamal al-Ziyarat, we have 19 narrations talking about that. For example, in one narration we read, كانت الجن تنوه على الحسين ابن علي عليه السلام. The jinn used to cry and mourn for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This is in Kamal al-Ziyarat, page 95, and Allama Majlisi also has quoted from Kamal al-Ziyarat, volume 45, page 241. Now, there are many discussions about whether all the narrations in Kamal al-Ziyarat are authentic or not. So there is a difference of idea among the Shia scholars. But as I mentioned, at least we have 11 narrations about this, and it seems that this is also well authenticated. And it seems natural that when you have the angels crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the jinn, they also knew about that and they have tried.
Also, it has been documented that an army of jinns were after helping Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We have also some narrations regarding that.
As for the remaining phenomena, when it comes to, an owl crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we have it, but the number of narrations are not many. So
an owl, a bird. Owl, you said, okay.
Yeah. So for this case, we cannot say that for sure it has happened.
Okay.
As for the eclipse, we have some narrations that on that very day an eclipse happened. It's been mentioned by both Shia and Sunni sources. And in some narrations, we see that the stars appeared during the day, which is, in line with the eclipse.
Yes.
Because when you have eclipse, then you will, we will be able to see the stars, and there are some narrations proving that too. And it's not against the order of the nature. So, that's for right. example, when for some peoples in the previous prophets, we see that for like Prophet Nuh alayhi salam, for many days we have rain. Is it against the order of the nature? No. So we cannot reject that story. Yes. For an eclipse to happen, for a great tragedy like the tragedy of Karbala, is it against the order of the nature? No. It can happen through a miracle. But the narrations, the reports that may talk about an event which seem to be against the nature of the physical world. For example, to see two suns on that very day.
Yes.
It seems that, I mean, the intellect, the, I mean, scientific yes. data, they reject
okay.
that.
Okay.
So we might say that the narrations which talk about some phenomena,
okay. yes.
which are